The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're going to take a look at Iraq. We have heard, of course, that President Barack Obama intends to withdraw troops by the deadline he set. Of course, many people argue that there will still be hundreds of thousands of troops in the Gulf area. But it does beg the question, as we've been arguing about, discussing since the beginning of this war on this radio program, about the efficacy of not just the war, but now that the war has been was declared and fought towards the end of the last decade, we've been talking about, so what do we do now? Troops are there. Iraq is in a chaotic crisis. What is America's responsibility? In that continuing discussion, we are really fortunate to have with us Peter Van Buren, who joins us by phone, a State Department career employee. He wrote this book, which is very illuminating, called We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And Adil Shamu has graciously joined us in the studio as well, who was born in Iraq. He is a scientist and a senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. And Adil writes a great deal about Iraq and our policies in the Middle East and policies in general. And Adil and Peter, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Peter, let me start with your book. I was just fascinated by the book because and also your situation. Having written this book, which is really an expose in some ways that goes to the heart of what all the critiques the Inspector General has written about Iraq, but kind of gives it this flavor of humanity and realism of what happens on the ground. But as a State Department employee, this book must not make you very popular with your higher-ups or your colleagues.
What I wrote, I never intended to be an expose or dissent or anything like that. I simply wrote down what I saw and what happened to me. The truth can be a nasty thing, and unfortunately the State Department has reacted very strongly against me, removing my security clearance and suspending me from work as punishment for publishing something that they didn't like. The State Department remains almost like the mafia in the sense that you aren't supposed to talk about the problems of the family outside the family. And by bringing these stories to light and trying to inform the American people of what was done or not done in their name, I've incurred the wrath of my employer.
But that is not uncommon, unfortunately, in today's world with people who do speak up. Both you and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice have both come out with books. And I would say the reception for the two books have been a little different.
It's been a little different. Condi started a war on false pretenses, helped kill off 4,479 Americans, over 100,000 Iraqis, spent trillions of dollars, destroyed America's image in the Middle East. And she's on The Daily Show making jokes with Jon Stewart. I wrote a book about the reality of what she pushed the United States into, and I've lost my job over it. So I'll leave it to you to decide how America wants to treat this war.
Well, let's talk about what you wrote about, and I would hope that little and all those folks in The Daily Show that they would have you on as well. It needs to be heard. At least some of the public radio shows are putting you on around the country, but as we are. But one of the things, you spent your life in the State Department working with like a super social worker in the beginning of your life, and won this super honor award for helping this rape victim in Japan. So, I mean, you have a long and a career in the State Department.
Yes, I worked for the State Department for over two decades, and primarily my work was in assisting American citizens overseas when Americans ran into trouble, were robbed, got arrested, lost their passports, were the victims of crime or terrorism. It was my job to help them and get them back home safely to the United States. I imagined at the time, after two decades of this, that my work in Iraq was going to be something similar, helping the Iraqi people get back on their feet, trying to repair through reconstruction some of the destruction that the United States caused from the invasion of 2003 forward. What I found instead was that we were charged more with creating Potemkin villages than anything that actually was going to help the Iraqi people. The money that we spent, the projects that we worked on, were designed more for America's benefit than anything that might help the Iraqis. We were interested in pictures and propaganda and happy, smiling faces, even if we never really addressed the real concerns of the Iraqi people, many of which we were the cause of.
Now, as my dear friend Adil Shamu is in the studio, and Adil, as the conversation unfolds, and before we jump into where we're going in the future, and you hear us speaking here with Peter Van Buren, feel free to jump in with questions and thoughts. As you hear, I would like to hear you interact with this as well. I want to throw out some of the things that you did bring out, and they were just amazing stories. When I said the human side of the story, it was that this was what happened on the ground, and you very clearly didn't use real names sometimes, or you use first names, or just call somebody Major or Colonel, in a way to kind of not expose other men and women on the ground that you worked with in Iraq.
Well, the point of that was not just as a reflection of our litigious society, but also to focus on what happened, not necessarily the people on the ground who were implementing these things. Many of these people were sincere. The title of the book, We Meant Well, is both somewhat ironic and also somewhat sincere. A lot of people were there, like me, trying to make the best of a bad situation, trying at least initially to do the right things. And so I felt that it was unnecessary to call these people out by names. That would shift the focus from what they did to who they were. And that really doesn't help the America going forward as we face similar adventures in Afghanistan, perhaps in Libya, Yemen, Somalia, where have you. And so I did choose to disguise the names, but the projects are all real, the stories are all real, and what happened there was all too real.
And you were part of something that was called the Provisional Reconstruction Team, the PRT. Describe that and what you were doing there.
What happened in 2003 is the initial plan that America was going to be welcomed as liberators in Iraq and that the Iraqi oil would flow and pay for the reconstruction of Iraq obviously fell apart almost immediately. A lot of actors tried to put the pieces back together again. The initial coalition provisional authority under Paul Bremer tried to fix things in Iraq. The Army Corps of Engineers, the Army itself, the big multinational contractors like KBR and Bechtel were all given billions of dollars to attempt to reconstruct the country. And all of them failed, which left pretty much in Washington only the State Department to give it a try. The theory of this was that by rebuilding Iraq, we would introduce democratic institutions. We would recreate an economy that would give people an alternative to insurgency and terrorism. And along the way, we would win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people and create for the United States a stable ally in the Middle East. These were all the theories, and we could argue on another show whether it was possible to have done better, but it would have been difficult for us to do worse. By emphasizing feel-good projects and propaganda attempts over anything that was seriously going to help development in Iraq, to build that base that creates the possibility of a later top, it just wasn't what we were doing.
Now, to talk a bit about some of these things, and I want to kind of focus in on, and I really want to hear, Adil, your analysis of which we hear here, that to talk about some of the things that you wrote about. Let me start with Mick Blazer.
Please.
Go ahead.
Mick Blazer was a symbol of what we sort of created in Iraq. We had very little time and lots of money, and that's a nasty recipe. We needed to satisfy the regular demands from the embassy for photos and success stories on a regular basis, and so we fell into a kinship with guys like a man we called Mick Blazer, an Iraqi who almost evolved to take our money. We couldn't go out and look around for people to help or price shop or anything along those lines. We simply had to throw money at someone and hope that they would do something with it that would reflect well on us. Mick Blazer was a slick, a card shark, a carpetbagger, a thief, who was happy to take our money, understood that we really were only interested in short-term results, and was very content at all this and profited financially. The very first thing that happened to me in Iraq, literally as I was getting off the helicopter, was that I was asked to sign false receipts so that we could overpay Mick Blazer for some things that he had done for us earlier in the week. It set a very bad tone for me, and I should have realized at that point this was not going to work out well.
But this kept tumbling even more. I mean, the stories you write about the engineer, about the chicken factory. I mean, it was just they kept the solar powered bottles that were supposed to bring water and turn them into drinking water. I mean, all these things that you wrote about, just I mean, they were mind boggling and made sense when you think of the $62 million the inspector general said went missing.
What we did, what I was writing about in the book, is the same problems that the inspector general chronicled on a large scale, but on a much smaller scale. We spent $2.5 million on a chicken processing plant that actually processed no chicken. We paid women to learn to bake pastries and hope that they would open little bakeries and solve the insurgency somehow that way. We gave money to farmers. We dug wells that didn't hit water. We bought machinery that was supposed to clean water, but that actually didn't work in Iraq's salty groundwater situation. And each of these things, which should have been a mini failure of its own, was actually spun into some form of success as we reported that we had spent money and things had happened on the ground. The only metric that we were ever asked to measure in Iraq was money. The chicken factory produced no chicken. That was irrelevant. What mattered was we had $2.5 million more democracy in place. Whether the test farms produced vegetables or not, again, irrelevant. What mattered is the ribbon-cutting ceremony, the pictures of the local dignitaries standing there shaking hands and grinning largely because of the money they were pocketing at the American taxpayers' expense.
And when you say money, I mean, you write about scenes that remind me of scenes I've covered and seen of hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash laying in your safe that you would be told to dole out, just cash.
Of all the things we lacked, including adult supervision perhaps, we did not lack money. The American government spent money in Iraq in ways that are stupefying. The money would arrive by aircraft on pallets, literally giant blocks of cash. I had $100,000 in my safe, and when we went out to make payments to the Iraqis that we worked with, we filled up shopping bags with $20,000 or $30,000 at a time. At one point, to encourage the Iraqis to respect their own currency, the embassy insisted that we start to make our payments not in U.S. dollars, but in Iraqi currency. I think at that time, the largest bill that was in circulation was worth about 50 U.S. And so we filled copier paper boxes with cash. And it became kind of a joke around the office. Well, we're going to go out and see so-and-so. That's about, what, a four paper copier job? Yeah, that's about right. And we would pass this money along like we were drug dealers. There was very little accounting for it. I'm pretty sure most of the people I personally worked with were reasonably honest, but the stories of literally millions of dollars simply going missing are legend and very much a part of the Iraq experience. All of these things are clues as to why things did not work out, why the most expensive nation-building project since the Marshall Plan ended in the chaotic, dystopian state that Iraq exists in today.
Adil, go ahead, please. Adil Shamoun.
Yeah, I want to ask, there was, to me, I don't know how you see it, a fundamental flaw that you could invade a nation of 27 million people and change their life within a few years and make them love us. After we have invaded and killed, at least at the beginning, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, and convert them into people who love us. It's just there's something fundamentally wrong. You're going to force them into loving us by invading them. That is, to me, more important flaw in Condoleezza Rice and George Bush and Rumsfeld's policy towards Iraq or towards any other nation.
I absolutely agree. And that remains one of the fundamental problems about nation building, hearts and minds, whatever you want to call it, is trying to convince people that the Americans who were killing them yesterday are now friendly today. A story I recount in the book, an Iraqi farmer, we came up and were giving away some tree seedlings to him. And he said to us, you know, the Americans, you killed my son, and now you're giving me a tree? And he spat on the ground and walked away from us. We never were able to address those issues, and we never confronted the fundamental question of why we were in Iraq, why we created the destruction. I found myself in many occasions as oftentimes one of the only Americans that Iraqis in our area had ever encountered, of having to absorb this incredible amount of hatred and distrust from people, and to listen to their stories, the husbands that were killed, the sons who were and daughters who were, quote, collateral damage when the Americans bombed a town. It remains, as the gentleman said, one of the fundamental issues of this nation-building campaign is how do we transition ourselves from killers to helpers, and would anyone want to believe us?
You know, we've been covering Iraq since the very beginning, even before the war, with very intense shows from people on all sides talking about whether or not we should be going to war with Iraq, and we're still talking about Iraq all these years later. But now it's a very different kind of conversation. And I wonder, Peter, as you look at this, I really want to hear Adil's reaction to this too. As you look at this, and you were sent there to do this reconstruction, mm-hmm. and clearly it has not happened. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the most epitomes to me was your story about the engineer, the mm-hmm. man who ran the water filtration plant.
Yes.
Who ran it during Saddam's era.
Yes.
And people I know who are Iraqis, who lived in Iraq during that time, people I know who visited Iraq before the invasion, said there was a water system and it did work and people did have fresh water. And he was working in a system that actually worked at some level before the invasion, before the war started. So, and I wonder when you reflect on that and reflect on what that the madness of not putting enough money, as you wrote about putting in money to fix one plant when we're talking about hundreds and more plants that needed to be repaired. What do you think could have been done? Could anything have been done after the war began to really do the kind of reconstruction that people thought was happening or that the government told us was happening?
It's hard to say if we could have actually achieved those very lofty goals, but it's very easy to say we could have done better. The example of the engineer in the water plant is a terrific one, Mark, because it reflects on, again, one of the underlying fundamental mistakes. The things that Iraqis needed most, water, electricity, sewage, medical care, things like that, things that governments had been charged with providing for people in Mesopotamia literally since the earliest prehistoric times, were not as important to us because they did not reflect our short-term goals. My provincial reconstruction team, PRT, was given some money and told to work on a water plant in our area. That was not a bad thing in and of itself, but I found out very quickly that no one was working on the facilities that were either upstream or downstream of us. Networks are made up of nodes, and if you're going to rebuild a country's water system or electrical system, you have to tackle it as a network problem. It requires a much higher level of organization and a higher level of coordination, and these are the kind of things governments actually evolved over time to provide, the Romans, the Babylonians, what have you. In our case, however, bureaucratically, the money was slated to fix one water plant, and that's where we were going to spend it. The poor guy stuck in the middle of all this had suffered through many, many years of neglect. He had actually started working as an engineer at this plant as a young man during Saddam's early years and told us wonderful stories about being sent off on educational missions to Bulgaria and communist Hungary at the time, and coming back with his pockets stuffed full of rubles and smuggled vodka. They were good times for him, and they represented a time when there was a functioning government in Iraq. And this is certainly not to defend Saddam or anyone like that, but to say that when the United States roared through Iraq in 2003, we shredded whatever civil society did exist. In the same process that swept up Chemical Ali and the secret police, we also made it very clear that we had no interest in the school teachers, the police officers, the guys who ran the telephone exchanges, all the people that make up a government, that make up a civil society, were all stripped of their jobs, and we literally devastated any framework of society that existed in Iraq, and then fumbled around for 8 years, picking at little pieces of it, before we finally got tired of it, ran out of money, and allowed the Iraqis to kick us out, as has happened today.
Well, I have a slightly even a different take in terms of there was arrogance of elitism that we're going to send these 20, 25-year-old kids, mm-hmm. Political appointee, to teach these Slavs, Iraqis, how to run their country from day one. They sent 22-year-old, freshly graduate from college, to run the whole transportation system in Baghdad. Never has done any transportation. Her degree was not in transportation. 22-year-old. That's what they did.
This is very true. I'm a little older than 22, but practically as ignorant. What the gentleman is talking about was in the very early stages of the Reconstruction, Bush campaign aides, the sons and daughters of big donors of Bush, they were sent over to try to live out their neocon fantasies. If they had studied economics at college, then they were suddenly put in charge of the Iraqi Stock Exchange or creating a flat tax or whatever crazy conservative things were going to be tried out in this laboratory of Iraq that people were suddenly let loose in. It was an incredible display of arrogance versus ignorance. It's hard to say which of the two overwhelmed it. By the time I arrived there, we had not really improved very much. I was equipped with a staff of so-called subject matter experts. They were all a little bit older and not connected with the Bush campaigns, but they were not much more helpful. In the State Department's desire to ramp up its role in Iraq to sort of match the manly military surge with a civilian surge, people were hired off of scanty resumes. None of their credentials were checked. Many times people had figured out that if they claimed to have an advanced degree in a subject, they would get paid more. And so, darn it, they were going to have those degrees. And that led to things like a gentleman who had served on his local city water board was suddenly rechristened a water and sewage expert. A female gym teacher from California showed up and was in charge of women's empowerment. They were folks who were former thises and once were thats. It was almost as if Boy Scout merit badges were taken and pushed forward. If you had a hobby that involved beekeeping, you became the agricultural advisor. And these folks were no more valuable to the Iraqis and no more valuable to Reconstruction than the 22-year-olds that showed up in the early stages of the war. It looked a little better. It was dressed up nicer. But at the end of the day, it accomplished nothing.
We are really fortunate to have with us Peter Van Buren, a State Department career employee. He wrote this book, which is very illuminating, called We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And Adil Shamu has graciously joined us in the studio as well, who was born in Iraq. He is a scientist and a senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are really fortunate to have with us Peter Van Buren, author of We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. You know, when I read your book and when I read the very serious, thoughtful work that people like Adil Shamu do about the war, especially Adil being an Iraqi and not understanding the politics but the soul of it, because that's where he lived and grew up and became became a scientist before coming to this country, wrestling with what we've wrought is something that I think that we're not doing. I mean, books like yours are making us do it. People like Adil make us think about it in terms of policy. But really wrestling with what we've wrought there, what we've done to – Saddam was a madman and a butcher and all the things
– We all agree on that.
Yeah. But what we've wrought in that name and how we deal with it now is something I don't think America, its government, or its people – even know how to begin to wrestle with.
We have a problem with what the military often refers to as unintended consequences. You do something, perhaps with good intentions, you may have in fact meant well, and all of a sudden the dominoes start tumbling and you just walk away from it. And that's certainly what's happened in Iraq. Saddam was taken out of power in 2003 and was executed in 2006. And yet we still stumble along in Iraq wondering what comes next. we as a country, we're almost like a large, silly child who thrashes about, breaks things, and then walks away from the mistakes and says, well, I'll just go somewhere else now.
What?
The United States has left behind a terrible legacy in Iraq of death, of destruction, of the destruction of civil society, and we simply are turning away and going off to repeat the same mistakes again in other parts of the Middle East and in East Africa. America, I think, enjoys remaining ignorant of the responsibilities for the things that it does, the actions that it takes, even as far as concerned taking care of our own soldiers. Everyone loves to talk about supporting the troops, but a new study for the New Americans from the New American Century says that soldiers take their own lives at the rate of one every 80 minutes.
That's
suicides,
right,
that are leftovers,
right,
of this war, echoes of the things that they saw and they did. These things aren't of concern to us. We'd rather argue about Herman Cain's sexual dalliances or better yet, what the Redskins are going to do next weekend. We need to open our eyes and understand that we're responsible for our actions. We're responsible for the unintended consequences of our actions as a people and as a nation.
Well, I speak from experience. Those poor soldiers who are morally, some of them, tormented by the war, just as you are when you were there, basically tormented to see your moral compass versus what you were doing there, or you were told what to do there. So what the solution we find out, hire more psychiatrists, hire more social workers, but worse, let's think of some drug we could basically dull their moral conscience. And that to me is an insanity to about 1.5 million. We have American soldiers who pass through basically Iraq, and some of them are tormented souls. And I feel for them. I really feel and cry for them.
Well, you know, and you can see it coming home now. I mean, as someone who has worked since the Vietnam War with other veterans of the war, from that war and all the wars since, one of my closest brothers who runs a program here for veterans, he's seeing already. He has 24 more Iraqi Afghan veterans in his facility. And the wars are just not even ended yet. To see that go on now, after what we learned 40 years ago, 50 years ago, in Vietnam, is just, I mean, it just renders me speechless sometimes. It just it does.
Well, what has happened, we all the time mention the 4,500 around who got killed, American got killed. But what has happened, we have nearly 40,000. But these are seriously, severely wounded.
Yes.
And the reason is because the survival rate went from the Civil War, where 90-95% died, to 90-95% survive. So these surviving soldiers, basically, they have severe disabilities. So in a way, we are whitewashing the actual number of death and wounded, because these wounded soldiers, they're going to be disabled for the rest of their life, and the cost is in the trillions of dollars for our economy.
And winding our way back to where we are with Iraq now and what else you wrote in this book, Peter, something that struck me, and I think, and I read your blog page, your page this morning, on the way in, and your latest piece that you put up about Reporters Without Borders.
Yes.
And Your story, this is important. I want to get this out, and I think it's really important to wrestle with here, is that the book you've written is now brought to a place where you're being attacked by the State Department and investigated, and who knows what will happen next. And so we defend bloggers in every other world, those who come out and attempt to talk about the truth and create dialogue in America are either fired or prosecuted.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the Department of State as an organization have aggressively supported the rights of bloggers and journalists throughout the Middle East, and particularly have claimed credit for the Arab Spring in part through their support of these people's right to speak openly, to criticize their government, to bring facts to light that are embarrassing to the Arab governments, but yet true and necessary for people to come to grips with. Unfortunately, the same organization, the Department of State and Secretary Clinton, don't believe that those same rules should apply here at home. As a State Department employee, I have had my security clearance suspended simply because I linked from my blog at wementwell.com to a WikiLeaks document that was counted as disclosure of classified information, and my security clearance was taken away from me. Without a clearance, you really can't do much in the government. It's actually the key to your employment. The State Department has gone on to suspend me, claiming that as a State Department employee, I have no right to blog without their permission, that they must pre-screen and clear everything that I were to write as a way of, quote, protecting the government. And in fact, these things stand in stark contrast to the rights and freedoms that the State Department tries to claim on behalf of Chinese dissidents and Iranian bloggers and things like that. The irony is knee-deep, and no one seems to, at the State Department, have enough of a sense of humor or a sense of perspective to understand that their actions here at home, and not just directed at me, but directed at other people who are writing, trying to help America understand its government, their actions here at home fully undermine their campaign overseas.
But what's happening in the State Department, to me, is an extension of President Obama's policy around the world in his foreign policy. We progressives voted for him and not for Hillary Clinton when she was running against him because, really, we thought he's going to be, you know, bring the war in Iraq to a close completely, and Afghanistan will diminish the war there. However, his policies really are an extension of the Bush policy. In Iraq, even though he's claiming that we have going to remove all U.S. troops, which is a very positive step, and I commend it. However, he's keeping there nearly 20,000 American personnel in Iraq in the largest embassy in the world, and they all have immunity. So the whole immunity discussion about our U.S. troops is really a fake discussion because we already have 20,000 people with immunity in Iraq, simply attach them to the U.S. embassy, including those couple hundred, by the way, U.S. troops who are going to be attached in the embassy. They are part of the diplomatic corps, and therefore they have immunity. So that whole camouflage, and we voted really for I voted for Obama to have transparency. I understand there has to be secrets. I'm with him there. Transparency, some degree of honesty about our policy, but that is really all down the drain now. We have obfuscation, half truth. Why doesn't he level with the American people that we are there in Iraq for a long, long time? We have even Liam Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, admitted we have 43,000 troops right there next to Iraq in Kuwait and the Gulf.
It is a shame that it is a shameful thing that as an American citizen, I have to stand up inside of the government and ask politely for the same rights that our government is demanding from Iran or Syria or China, that I have to stand up and say, please, sir, may I have some more as an American citizen? I think that our government had lost a bit of its mind following 9/11 and the crusades against terrorism and the crusades against the empire of evil and the crusades against this or that have replaced in many ways rational thought. As Amal makes the point, we're not leaving Iraq. We're just changing the landlord's name. The State Department built the world's largest embassy in the Green Zone, bigger than the Vatican, visible from space, and is currently staffing up its own occupying force, 5,000 mercenaries whose job is ostensibly to protect the diplomats from the Democratic Society of Iraq. The State Department will have its own armed helicopters, its own armored vehicles, its own armory and machine guns. That doesn't represent diplomacy, which is what the purpose of the Department of State has been for the last 250 years. It represents a militarization of foreign policy that replaces negotiation and dialogue with punishment. If you agree with us and you're an evil dictator in a country like Bahrain or Saudi Arabia, the money flows, the weapons flow, and America's largesse falls into your lap.
And we close our eyes to your torturing and arresting innocent people, including doctors, by the way, in Bahrain.
Absolutely.
22 healthcare providers were sentenced to 15 years in jail for treating their countrymen when they were wounded. That's all they did. And that is, by the way, the medical code of ethics. That is the Arab tradition of respecting the code of ethics of doctors. We violated every principle, but as long as they are our buddies, we close our eyes. This is why lack of moral consistency in our foreign policy, it really demean our foreign policy and it undermine our foreign policy. We claim we are for freedom and democracy as long as you are compliant to our U.S. foreign policy.
And this goes back to the fundamental underpinnings of reconstruction of hearts and minds that Amal mentioned earlier. The United States roared into Iraq claiming that we were there to free the people from an evil dictator, to promote democracy and an open society. We kept up that line. We keep up that line even today. But at the same time, our actions speak louder than our words. And we allowed an election in March 2010 to take place where someone who didn't win the vote ended up running the government. We allowed the Iranians to move in and begin their influence in Iraq in ways that they could have never imagined before 2003. We replaced farmers' sons with tree seedlings. We tried to offer beekeeping kits and chicken processing factories in return for the freedoms that we originally promised the Iraqi people. And we repeat these mistakes in country after country after country. You can't win someone's hearts and minds with that level of hypocrisy.
And we spent $500 million to influence the Iraqi election.
The issues remain real. As much as America wishes to turn a blind eye to these types of things, the people that are experiencing them on our behalf, if you will, the Iraqis, the Afghanis, the people in East Africa, they know what's going on. We may not here in suburban United States understand that drone strikes are killing innocent people here and there in the name of fighting terrorism, but the people on the ground, they most certainly do. One of the most stirring moments, sobering moments, occurred in Iraq. I was reading a book called Black Hearts, and it chronicles horrendous rape and murder committed by American soldiers in Iraq in the early years of the war. A 14-year-old girl was gang raped. She was shot. Her body was set on fire. Her family was killed in their home as witnesses. And I was reading this book, and I was just horrified by the story that was unfolding. And about two-thirds of the way through the book, I realized that the incident had taken place about 2 miles from where I was sitting. It was in the area that I worked every day. It was in the area that I had responsibility for. And no one in any of my briefings at the State Department had felt the need to mention this to me. None of the soldiers that I worked with were even vaguely aware that this incident had taken place near us, albeit a few years earlier. Our ignorance, however, was not an excuse, because we could be damn certain that the Iraqis that we worked with knew about it, remembered it, remembered the family whose lives were taken because American soldiers decided to gang rape their daughter. They didn't talk about it, but they thought about it, and it influenced every action that they took against us, and every time that we attempted to move things a little bit into the positive column, this loomed in the background. As ignorant as we were, the people that we worked with understood, and that's something that haunts America's foreign policy now around the world. We can pretend it's not true. We can speak in double talk. We can claim that defunding UNESCO is part of the peace process. But the people on the ground, they understand. And when they look at you and when they watch the American soldiers and our vehicles roar by, their eyes tell a story that we can deny, but we can't run from.
But that was very obvious when Hillary Clinton went to Egypt at the early part of when Mubarak was overthrown. The youth leadership refused to meet with her.
Let me ask the two of you this question, and I know in a minute Peter, with your schedule, you have to run. But Peter Van Buren, as a lifelong State Department employee,
mm-hmm.
we've been involved in diplomacy. And Adil Shamu is somebody who has been looking at foreign policy and studying it and looking at how America works in the world. Talk to me and our listeners about what you both think is the reality of what we could do otherwise. Because some people would argue, and I'm sure many of your colleagues very forcefully would argue, Peter Van Buren, that the realpolitik means that both of you guys are just naive, that this is not how the world works, that we have to protect the oil that exists where we have. We have to create a geopolitical situation that we are can control, and if not, someone else is in control. And what you're saying about this kind of humanitarian look at the world foreign policy, it sounds great, but it isn't real. Now, how would you two respond to that?
Realpolitik is not necessarily the worst position for a country to take if, in fact, the United States had the courage to do it. If we were willing to say to the world, I'm sorry, we need your oil, and we're going to do what we need to do to secure it, I don't know that that would make us loved, but it would certainly reflect honestly on the United States, and I think that honesty would have some benefits to it. What the United States does is thread the needle in the worst possible way. We pursue a policy of control. We pursue our own needs for oil very aggressively. But at the same time, we constantly are spouting off about democracy and freedoms and human rights. It makes us look like hypocrites. It reduces our stature. It reduces people's willingness to accept and work with us. You can't eat oil.
Well,
you can only sell it, and I think there would always remain a market for oil if the United States would be honest enough to simply admit that that is our foreign policy goal, and the rest of this just kind of put the rhetoric away for a little while and earn some points for honesty out there.
We haven't tried the honest way. I mean, we have no basis of comparison. We have gone through this basically obfuscation, half-truth, and sometimes lying to the rest of the world about our foreign policy. Here is to me, when I teach students, I try to simplify things. If you have a family friend, half of the time he lies to you and half of the time tell you the truth. What was your position going to be with that friend? Would he stay as your good friend? Would you want him to socialize with your teenagers and children and grandchildren? I mean, that's really the problem here. The Arabs know when Bahrain kills people, torture people, arrest doctors, okay, and we say nothing, while Syria or Iran, if one get killed, right, we are yelling and screaming freedom and democracy and this corrupt government. But if Jordan does it, if Saudi Arabia does it, okay, when Mubarak did it, when children were raped while they were being interrogated in Cairo, we were silent as long as he was a compliant agent for us. Remember, you know, I mean, I'm talking about compliant agents. It's not in the old days, like 50 years ago. Agent really does exactly what you tell them. But in modern form of what I call it, influencing other people's policy. And that is really where we need to try principles which America basically carries in their torch, in the Statue of Liberty. Why can't we do that and see if it works for a couple decades? I think it will work. We will gain greater respect. Yes, we need oil. Yes, we cannot live without oil. The West will go dark without oil. Where in the heck Saudi Arabia and Iraq will sell the oil? I mean, they will pay, you know, they will ask for a certain price. It's a market price. And we will get that oil. Guess what? They will suffer more than we do if they don't sell us the oil. Guess what? They need to buy all our products. We have a huge amount of products. They daily want it. They are not at that stage yet of independence, and they won't be.
Do you – now, Peter, in watching what's going – you heard what Adil said. I'm curious before as we wind down.
Mm-hmm.
And how many years were you in the State Department? I forgot what the book said. You were in there for
– how many? 23 years.
23 years. So this is your life.
Was my life.
Was my life. Was your life. I'm sorry. Do you think, as Adil was saying, it can be done in another way, or do you think that's just not in the nature of the beast?
It would be very difficult. That level of internal honesty is something that I don't think I've witnessed inside the U.S. government. We tend to more and more lie to ourselves the same way we lie to the outside people. We spend a lot of time inside the buildings convincing ourselves that what we're doing is good and pure and right. And to try to make that turnaround would be an effort that I suspect at my most cynical as being impossible. That said, the alternatives are very stark. We have witnessed what happens in the world when we attempt to replace diplomacy with punishment, where we militarize our actions overseas, where the only people that foreigners encounter anymore, or the only Americans foreigners encounter anymore, are wearing uniforms and carrying weapons. Sometimes when everything else hasn't worked, the one last thing out there is worth a desperate try. And I think that it's time for America to come to grips with these realities and see if it isn't possible in some small way to try to turn this ship around, to present a different face of the United States to the world, one that threatens less and listens more, one that promotes diplomacy over military intervention, one that seeks cooperation instead of punishment, one that recognizes our need for resources with at the same time recognizing that international commerce is perhaps one of the most successful ways of keeping the peace. It can't hurt. It might help. And I dearly wish America would wake up and give it a try.
A final thought.
We voted for a president to do that. We thought there would be a change, true change, fundamental change in our foreign policy. And to my disappointment and disappointment of tens of millions of other progressives really around the country, our policies, our foreign policy remained an extension of the Bush policy. And that is sad. And no wonder Condoleezza Rice's book is received sort of by some of the media well lately. And her explanation for all her ill-conceived policies are, we are imperfect human and dealing with imperfect people.
This has been a fascinating discussion. I want to say that Peter Van Buren, your book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, was really written with real insight, very honestly, with great humor, and I would say great bravery to put the stuff on the pages you put on. And I commend you for what you've written. And just say that I know that in your isolation, that are in our small way, if you need a voice or any media protection out there as a kind of conversation, we're always open to you.
Mark, thank you very much for that, and thank you for your kind words about my book. I don't consider myself very brave. I don't think that I set out to tilt it at any castle walls
right
here. I simply wanted to tell people what I saw and what I experienced in Iraq. What's happened after that to me is less relevant. What's important is the story that I have to tell, and to the extent that people can be better informed about what America's doing overseas, that should be what remains most important.
But what's interesting, you told it to the American people. Like you said also, the Iraqis know it already, and they know even a bigger picture and many, many more examples than any book can describe, basically.
Yes.
Adil Shamu, Senior Analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, and your new book coming out next year is called?
Equal Worth, When Humanity Will Have Peace.
And this has been kind of the heart of your writing for a long time. I can't wait to see the entire book come out.
Yes, I've worked 5 years on it.
And Peter Van Buren, author of We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, a lifelong dedicated civil servant with the State Department. I thank you very much for being with us as well.
Mark, thank you very much. And Amal, thank you for your remarks as well.
And thank you, Peter.
And we'll look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you.
Take care. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.